Welcome back to Hair the Werewolf, a weekly supernatural and horror-themed podcast. I'm Chase, and I'm here with Lily.
Heyo.
Each episode, we attempt to scare each other with research stories from around the world, and admittedly, sometimes a few that are out of this world. It's been a while since our last episode, but fear not, we have some good stuff for you today. Lily has been hard at work on her latest story, and I'm really excited to hear about it. So, I mean, I'm being responsible with water today, but Lily's doing alcoholic Jarritos.
Yeah, it's pineapple. A little Jarritos. It's the hard soda, I guess. I think it's real sugar, probably. I was worried it was going to be whatever.
Aspartame.
Or like other sweeteners that they've been using, which is fine. Like, I totally get it. But if I'm on a diet, this is not the place I'm trying to cut my calories.
Exactly. Like, I no disrespect to people who like a lot of those artificial sweeteners. I'm glad they work for you, but I hate the way they taste, and sometimes they actually really affect my stomach.
They mess
like
me
Splenda.
Up.
Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, if I can't have normal sugar, I'm just cutting out sweet things. Right. I'm not finding some weird, ugh.
Exactly. Yeah. I suppose that's just where my reasoning is. I recommend it. I'm doing the pineapple. Do it up.
What's pineapple in Spanish again?
Piña.
Oh, duh, because piña colada.
Yeah, I was waiting for you.
It's so upsetting that, like, I'm so doubtful of my Spanish ability, because I actually do know a lot of Spanish, but I'm so doubtful of it. I always ask Lily a word, and then she'll tell it to me, and I'm like, I know that word.
Like, why we use it all the time.
Why did I ask? Because I just feel really stupid.
Yeah. Now, I understand. Now that I'm taking, like, another language class, which I think, I don't even know if we've ever even talked about it on this podcast.
Yeah, we're taking German together.
Yeah, so I'm just, like, so nervous to talk. I kind of get it. I get the sweats when it's, like, my turn to say something. I start feeling... But I go into my retail mode where I'm like, screw it, I'm just going to, like, go for it. But truly, if I was in the country trying to speak whatever it is that I learned, I'm going to be terrified. I'm going to be so quiet. They're going to be like, speak up, I have no idea what you're saying.
Well, I get worried about it too, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that no one in the class seems to pronounce anything the same way, and it's not getting corrected by the instructor very often, so... I'll hear three different ways to pronounce something. I'm like, well, I thought it was this way. And
when I'm saying things, I'm like looking at her face, waiting for anything to change. She's just so like stonewalled. And I'm like, I think everything I said, I know it's trash. I know it's trash.
I think she's looking at all of us and just being like, there's nothing I can do.
I think she's just dead inside.
At least I'm getting paid for this. These people are stupid.
She's like, I don't fucking care. But I know how to identify words a lot more now, so at least that's helpful. Whether I can say them, that's a whole nother situation.
I think the hardest part about taking a new language, though, is you'll mention to someone, you'll be like, I'm taking German. And then they go, oh, say something in German.
Immediately.
It's like, I was like, I've been taking it for a month. We're still learning how to say their alphabet.
I was like, I just went through the alphabet. I can tell you the weird ones that I didn't expect, but I don't know anything else.
Yeah, if I could learn something fluently in a month to be able to say anything at a whim, then I would have taken like 70 languages by now.
Actually, I would say I've gotten two reactions every time I say I'm taking German. One, yes, say something in German. And two, they'll say something to me, like a full sentence. And I'm like, first of all, how do you fucking know German? And second of all, I don't even know what that is.
It's still the same level of not understanding. You say, I just started taking German. And they're just like, oh, of course you're fluent. I bet you know everything about German.
I was like, one, I'm kind of happy that you think I'm that smart, but I'm not. So it's going to take me as long as the rest of you people.
But you forgot the third thing that happens, the third reaction to when we tell people we're taking German. And that's them going, why?
Oh, yeah. I was like, I don't know.
I mean, why do you take any language? So I guess for fun.
For funsies.
For us, the reason is we're playing with the idea of going to Germany for this next Christmas to do Krampusfest. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it'd be fun and creepy and all that good stuff. And we said, why not? We got the time. Let's take the language.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So, you know, now that we've wasted everyone's time talking about our stupid German classes, I think it's time for Lily to jump into her story, because you've been researching this for so long that it better be good.
Okay, so on and off, I went with this one. I was actually starting another one. It always happens that way with me, I guess.
But you have to remember, I'm in the same place as our listeners. I've been waiting forever for this.
Oh, sure. The guy who just finished his research today.
I've been a last-minute guy my whole life. I'm not going to stop now.
That's true. That's how we got through college, and it worked out anyway.
C's get degrees.
Ooh, girl. Actually, what are you talking about? You graduated with honors or whatever.
Yeah, I know. But still, same difference.
Anyway. That's usually my line. Okay. So let's start from the beginning. Today, I'm going to talk about the Philip experiment. Does this sound familiar at all?
No, because at first I was like, yeah, but then I was remembering the Philadelphia experiment, which you covered on a previous story.
Right, right, right.
So no, I don't know the Philip experiment.
Okay. I'm not expecting
one way or another. Does it have anything to do with Wilson Phillips?
I wish, but no. Right. Or Phillips.
Philip.
What is that called? I don't know.
All the music.
There you go. The story gave me a lot of Ghostwatch vibes. I know you remember that story.
Sweet, sweet.
Yeah. So the Philip experiment was conducted by the Toronto Society for Physical... Oh, no, wait. Psychical... Sorry. Psychical Research, which is TSPR for short, because that was a mouthful for me, apparently, in 1972 for the purpose of inventing a fictional spirit and seeing if the spirit can be communicated through various methods like a seance or a Ouija board.
Wait. So is this a way of testing if people are full of it by you create something fake and see if people have interactions with a fake thing?
There's a lot of, okay, here's the thing. It can be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
Oh, okay.
But they had to have an objective.
Okay.
And theirs very specifically was to create an entity. They wanted to manifest something.
Okay, so they were doing this with the belief that they could hopefully manifest.
Something.
As opposed to they're not testing to see if people, they're not doing the Harry Houdini trying to prove seance is wrong thing here.
No, they weren't necessarily doing that.
Okay, because I wasn't sure if you meant, like, they walked into a house and they told a bunch of, like, paranormal people, there used to be a girl here named Evelyn, even though there wasn't, and they're just like, we're going to see if they can find Evelyn.
And then see if they feel anything.
Oh, so they're trying to see what can actually be.
Yeah, they're not trying to bamboozle anyone into believing that this person exists. They want to create
game
it.
Game ever!
Ever! So, yeah, that's their goal. Right.
And their TSPR?
TSPR.
Like I'm not going to. Teaspoon with an R?
Teaspoon with an R. Aww.
Doesn't that sound like something you want when someone says, do you want a drink? You're like, I'll take a teaspoon. Like a little teaspoon amount of liquor. Like, put a teaspoon in that coffee for me.
Why use the old terms like a dash or a pinch? Now we got teaspoon.
A little teaspoon. Teaspoon in my coffee.
Of course. This is so amazing. Yeah. So, like I said, the objective is to create a ghost or poltergeist. And within the minds of the believers. Can you make a ghost out of thin air? We'll see.
And his name is Philip.
The team was led by mathematical geneticist Dr. A.R. George Owen. And the rest were Iris Owen, who's married to Dr. Owen. Former chairperson of Mensa in Canada, Margaret Sparrow. Now, there's going to be a lot of names that I'm going to
I'm
going to
forget all of them.
I literally do not expect you or anyone else to remember them. The reason why I'm going to list them and their qualifications is because of their qualifications. So many times off the bat, before I even finish a sentence, people are already rolling their eyes. And it's like, this person who went to second grade only. I don't know why.
And sees stuff from his barn house.
Yeah, and he stole another cow. I mean, I get why people, don't want to credit these people in a way, which is kind of unfortunate.
Sure.
Whatever reason. So off the bat, that's not going to be the reason why you have any skepticism. So anyway, the next guy that's in the group is industrial designer Andy H. and his wife Lorne, or Lorny, I don't know. Heating engineer Al Peacock, accountant Bernice M., bookkeeper Dorothy O'Donnell, sociologist student Sydney K., and lastly, psychologist Dr. Joel Witten, who was technically part of the group, but was there solely to oversee the experiment. So he wasn't participating, really, but he needed to make sure that what he was observing was being recorded.
But these other people were subjects, I'm assuming, as opposed to they weren't initiating the experiment. They were literally participating.
They are going to be part of the manifestation process. Like, they're going to believe this.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, because when you said, heating engineer and bookkeeper, I'm like, these aren't particularly important qualifications.
No, but I meant, tend to be more by the book. Or,
they have jobs.
They have jobs, and they're not going to be, I don't know. It's not like I'm saying, and then medium, blah, 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 and psychic involved.
They're not
These are,
paranormal.
Regular people.
Cool.
Yeah. So the idea from the experiment came from Dr. Owen and Iris Owen. And another important detail before I dive in is that everyone who was on the team self-proclaimed that they had absolutely no psychic abilities.
Okay, okay.
So that is important for what's coming. Because what happened during the experiment is still widely debated among paranormal communities. So we'll see.
Did you give me a time frame? Did I already forget the time frame?
Yes, you did. Where did I say it? I might have said it. I might have not. It's 1972.
Ah, damn. In my head, it was in the 90s. But my heart is always in the 90s.
I was going to say.
I guess when someone says something used to happen, to me, it should always be the 90s. So I guess it's before that. It's the boring time before the 90s.
It's before 90s. The 70s are kind of cool. They had some cool styles.
It was the coolest time before the 90s.
Sure, sure.
You have to skip over those nasty 80s.
Oh, sure.
Everyone under the age of 25 just went,
I was like, how dare you?
You do not speak about the 80s. I grew up partially in the 80s. It was awful. I'm glad it's over.
I mean, I remember, I guess, 1 to 5. I don't know. I remember being at home before school. Cool, the 80s. So let's talk about the spirit. They created a man called Philip Aylesford. Aylesford, I think is how I say it. I actually forgot to look this up, how to say it. Anyway, they made up what he looked like, who he was in general, and into incredible detail as well. The team spent a lot of time researching to ensure that the time frame Philip would have lived in was accurate and also like in tune with the character. They spent weeks creating their fake spirit, and this is what they came up with.
All right.
This is almost like a direct source from liveabout.com. I got it from an article there. I didn't bother really rewriting it my own way because it's more or less the same stuff. So here we go. Philip was born in England in 1624, and by the age of 16, he was in the military and had been knighted. Around this time, tension was building that led to the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland, aka the British Civil Wars, which eventually led to the death of King Charles I in 1649. It was also a time when witch hunts were at its most intense, which is an important detail. With that said, Philip was a big supporter of the king and was Catholic. One day, he met Dorothea, a nobleman's daughter, who eventually married on his property, I think. However, shortly after, Dorothea became cold and violent during arguments. Philip became horribly depressed and often spent his days out riding around his estate to be away from his wife. Being Catholic and all, divorce was out of the question. So one day, when out riding, Philip came across a group of traveling Romani people, and among them saw a beautiful blue-eyed girl with raven hair named Margot. It was love at first sight. Unable to be apart, he brought her back secretly to live in the gatehouse near the stables of Diddington Manor, his family home. From time to time, he kept his love a secret, but eventually, Dorothea found out. Knowing that her husband would likely deny his affair when confronted, he decided to take advantage and revenge on Margot by accusing her of witchcraft and stealing her husband. So Philip was far too scared of losing his reputation and all his possessions to protest these accusations and to help Margot during her trial. So she was convicted of witchcraft and burned at the stake. Philip was subsequently stricken with remorse and spent most of his time pacing the battlements of Diddington in despair. Finally, on an early morning in 1654, Philip decided to end his life. He would have been 30 years old. So it's a very...
Damn, that's young.
There was more detail to it, but that's basically the bulk of it.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Whatever. The reason why they had to be so intricate with their story when they actually created it is because they wanted to be able to ask questions that only Philip would know. Does that make sense? But then the group know. I don't know. It's weird. So once they nailed down the lore, the team hired an artist to sketch out a portrait of Philip. This was also very important because it allowed the group to have an image of what they could focus on and avoid any inconsistencies. So the communication of Philip. Finally, it was time for the first seance. Everyone was asked to focus and believe strongly that Philip was once a real person and were now channeling the spirit. Their gathering was a bit informal. They were in a fully lit room and were only asked to collectively visualize Philip and his story. One person was would be asking Philip questions or asking to appear while the rest of the group would be meditating. It was honestly nothing too complicated. They met up once a week for a year. A week, a whole year.
52 times.
52 times. And the results were disappointing. I'll save you the time and energy that I read through what they were experiencing or not. But basically, nothing was concrete. Some claimed to feel a presence in the room, but they were like, that's not anything. Mm-hmm. So next, they decided, okay, we got to set up a more classic seance atmosphere and try more conventional techniques.
Man, so, they went 52 times before they decided, let's like try this hardcore.
I know. And that's what I thought was so weird. And I was like reading all these different articles and it was more or less, yeah, like a year of nothing.
That's commitment.
That's a lot. Maybe they were partying and they're like, okay, for real, guys. I don't know.
And most of us can't even do a diet for a month. I know. And they're just like, let's try this for a year. And if nothing happens, like if a doctor told you, like you come to a doctor with a problem, they got an issue, he's like, okay, try this out for a year and then we'll adjust it. You're like, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give you a couple months.
But the thing is that I'm just like, I'm almost certain they were just hanging out and partying. I mean, I don't mean like party crazy. I just think like
yeah, they weren't doing keg stands.
No, I just meant like a couple beers. Yeah, like a meetup. They're hanging out. They talk. They focus on Philip, and then they have a beer. Blah blah blah.
I bet everyone was just asking that bookkeeper for all the crazy gossip.
Give me the goss. Yeah, so that's kind of what they were doing. But then again, like I said, they were really to kind of hanker down and get it together.
All right.
The lights were dimmed. Everyone sat around a round table, surrounded themselves with imagery relating to Philip, placed their fingers on the table, sang songs, and once again called out to Philip. Only four sessions later, with their new setup, they experienced something paranormal for the first time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everyone reported feeling vibrations under their fingertips and then hearing a knocking coming from the table. They set rules for Philip to ensure clear communication, I should say. Like one knock for yes, two for no, and little things like that. Mm-hmm. They would initially spend a lot of time asking Philip questions relative to his life and what happened at that time. And as a result, Philip would answer everything exactly, like everything was accurate.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, there was no doubt in their mind that Philip was finally communicating, or at least they had to believe it was Philip, because otherwise there was a risk of breaking the manifestation. So it's weird because the experiment was pretty intense. Like if anything happened, the group was told to believe it was Philip. They needed to avoid any doubt and any outer rationalization.
So they had to push out the ideas in their mind that maybe we are conjuring a different spirit.
Yeah.
And we're,
it's Philip.
That'd be hard because I'd be like, why out? Because they know that Philip was fake. They're trying to create.
Trying to create it. And they can only do that if you focus.
And in my mind, the part of me says, well, that wouldn't be possible. So I would just assume it's something else. And I'd be like, we're fucking around with stuff we shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a bad idea. Ooh, all right.
We'll see. So this was a very intense approach. Mm-hmm. Most people who are participants in seances, like you were saying, would say weren't necessarily briefed to believe one way or another.
Sure.
If I wanted to think maybe it was the wind, that shouldn't affect the outcome or the happenings of a seance. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like if that demon is coming through that portal, oh, it's coming. But in this kind of scenario, it was very different. So we'll see. Other things that were occurring was that the table they were performing the seances on began sliding around the room.
Mm.
Not aggressively, but what they would describe as a playful manner. That's literally how they kept saying it. They're like, oh, Philip.
Well, at least Philip wasn't a jerk. They didn't manifest a prick.
Yeah, exactly. He's fine. The lights would flicker upon request. Objects in the room would levitate and disembodied whispers could be heard. As the group continued to meet up, like every week, the stronger Philip's presence became, which only fueled the group's influence on what they believed, I feel. Like, you know what I mean? Sure. It only fed into it, and they had to believe it was Philip. After some time of consistent results, the group decided to invite other people as a witness to their seances.
Mm-hmm.
Or sessions, because there wasn't always a seance. Sometimes it was a Ouija board. Sometimes it was whatever.
Sure.
But they were traditional communication methods. The advantage of treating these gatherings like an experiment was that there was a lot of data collected. There is a video you can watch on YouTube. The video is old and not cleaned up, but it's a little difficult to see and hear everything as well. It's unfortunate. It's 1972, y'all. Like, no one had sick camera phones.
Yeah, but we also live in an age that when we have sick camera phones, people still take crappy videos, so.
I mean, there you go. Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
Now, the video was filmed by a news crew that was invited to witness a seance. It showed the group sitting around a small table with everyone's fingers resting on top. After some convincing, the table started to shake and somewhat hover.
What?
It was difficult to see everyone with everyone around it, I will admit. Like, when you're watching, you're like, yeah, is the table shaking? Yeah, people are saying it's hovering.
But could people be using their legs?
But I couldn't see very well. There's so many people around this small table. The table began to tilt to one side very slowly to where it was only standing on two legs. Now, while the group sang, the table turned completely upside down. So, you know what I mean? Like, it was on two legs, tilting, mm-hmm. now on its side, and then flip upside down. And it was pretty slow, so you're kind of like, what? It kind of looks weird, but not so unbelievably.
Sure.
That it could have been manipulated or mm-hmm. either way. It just had left enough doubt, in my opinion. Anyway, the group maintained their fingers on the table and proceeded to ask Philip some questions. Wait.
How do they maintain their fingers on the table if it flips upside down?
Oh, so they had it now up on the other side, but they had their fingers on the table the whole time. Whether or not it was on top, the technical top, but it was underneath the top.
So you mean as it was flipping over, they were just moving their hands to the other side?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
I don't know if that makes sense. So now they were kind of like kneeling down.
And you can see
down.
This in the video?
Yeah, you can
totally see. Because I'm having a really hard time. I just saw like flip off to the side. You're like, but their fingers are showing. I'm like, what is happening?
So they're just like following it. And they look weird because they're crouching. They're kind of over each other and they're bending
so
over.
So when you said could be doubt, meaning since it's going slowly, this could just be people manipulating it.
Very possible. Very possible.
All right. They just needed to increase their funding because they didn't want their 52 weeks of hangouts to stop.
Yeah, exactly. They're like,
we got to make something happen or they're going to stop funding us.
Yeah. So as their fingers were still on the table, they would continue to ask Philip questions like, would you like a beer? Then there was a knocking, or what people would say, rapping sound, with a respond of yes. And this was actually recorded. So you can actually hear a knocking sound.
Okay.
It was faint. And I think what the crew was having an issue is that they had like an overhang holder. What do you call them? It's like a microphone.
Yeah, the arm for the holds the boom mic.
The boom mic. And then they were like trying to get over the group of people.
Sure.
And they were trying to hear it. And eventually they got the sound. It was interesting. The group continued to communicate with Philip for over 4 years.
The film crew, however, left.
Yeah, they were not around. Despite their impressive findings, they still couldn't reach their ultimate goal, which was to produce a physical manifestation or apparition. By the fifth year, Dr. Owen decided that the group could not succeed in completing their goal and terminated the experiment. Dr. Owen proceeded to conduct another similar experiment that had very similar results to Philip, but still there was no apparition. I mean, there is a lot of data out there. There's some like recordings that you can hear, audio. I don't know how much film there really was. Like I said, it would have been pretty mm-hmm. pricey at the time and what they were conducting. I don't know if it was too like wishy-washy to like, you know, justify that kind of funds. But there is a video online that as the public could view. I think there's like multiple books I've read about it from either believers to non-believers. And I don't know, it's pretty interesting. There are some theories, of course, and I think you've kind of touched on one, but let me go through them. Now, there is one that people talked about. It's an aura energy that can be harvested, like a psychokinetic abilities kind of type thing. This belief that there are auras that inherently exist around a human, and all we need to do is to harvest that energy and, you know, using complete concentration to be able to kind of move and manipulate or even create sounds. It's very strange. It kind of started sounding like Star Wars for a bit. And I was like, I don't get it. But it's actually kind of something that you can see in a lot of different cultures, which I found kind of interesting, like the concept of it. So it's not totally out of the blue.
And if you want to hear more about it, go to your local store that sells crystal balls and dragon statues, and they'll tell you all about it. Incense required.
Hey, those are cool. So another one is accidentally contacting a real spirit but not Philip.
See, this is where my brain was going. It's not just spirits, though. We also talk about how demons and... Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take like a super popular movie as the example, The Conjuring, which first showed us Annabelle.
Oh, sure.
And they said that, like, someone said that they like, gave permission for this girl to go into Annabelle, but it wasn't a girl. It was a demon pretending to be a girl.
It was trying to, like, infest you. Like, it was lying to you to get close to you. Yeah.
So if you are of the mindset where you believe in this kind of stuff, demons and spirits, if you believe in that kind of stuff, then it should be not outside of the realm to understand that demons, which are infamously written about and talked about to be mischievous,
right,
deceiving, diabolical, that if you're trying to create a fake entity, it'd be like, man, you guys are making this so easy. I don't even have to pretend to be like someone's dead uncle or grandma or something
and
like
see
that.
See, if I hit it on the head, I mean, you gave me all the information.
And this person's fake.
Right.
So it's like, I can be whatever I need to be.
Exactly. And they would have like pictures of Philip on the table a lot of the time. They would recite things that, you know, his history and where he was. So, because they were trying to, like, honestly, almost obsessively think about Philip constantly so that they can create this entity. And, yeah, so if there's any spirit or weird demon listening about, he's going to know everything.
And that's the reason I wouldn't want to be in this experiment. Because even though I don't know whether or not I believe in that stuff, if it does exist, this is exactly what I'd be terrified
of
doing.
I'd
be like, I don't even be part of that.
I wouldn't even be in the building. I was like, y'all, I'm just going to leave the city for a second while you rip open a portal to hell.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they're, you know, they are opening a window so that anything can crawl in. And that's just basically what, that is my biggest theory. Like, if any of these kind of activities were actually occurring and no one was manipulating anything, I'm thinking it was just like a spirit that was like, this would be hilarious. And then, you know, hang out.
These guys are so stupid. Let's play a prank.
The other one are hallucinations. This one I'm kind of on the fence about. I'm
group
kind of on board.
Hallucinations are hard.
They are hard. But, okay, so our brains in general are incredibly wild. I feel like I'm in a constant motion of reining in my own emotions, just maintaining normalcy. Like, I know most people feel that way. For some, it's anxiety, stress, sure, major life events, whatever. We're constantly trying to control our emotions. That's how I view it, literally.
Yeah,
like, we get pissed at the grocery store because someone, like, whatever, got in front of you. You're like, rein it in. I just, all the time. And so what happens when you can't or you're not totally in control, either internally or externally? The obvious example being, like, schizophrenia, but that's, like, a disorder. So 70% of people have visual hallucinations, 90% audio. That's an extreme, like I said, example, but even at the basic level, we all literally hallucinate when we sleep. Again, not entirely similar, mostly because we're not contacting the reality. Like, we're not in the reality when we're dreaming. It's a totally different set of neural network connections, apparently. So what's the in-between? Like, why did these science-minded, mostly science-minded professionals that knew from the second they began the experiment that everything was made up still experience physical and auditory events? Like, firstly, they were instructed to ignore any doubt, is my assumption. Basically taking away their control and what we would naturally do, reining in our emotions. So they were like, no, like, pour it out. Like, sure, it's Philip, it's real. And it's kind of just unable to filter or rationalize in the moment. So that's basically one theory kind of thing. So I think people are saying, basically, you can hallucinate if you try hard enough. Which is interesting because it's kind of like saying you can create an entity if you try hard enough.
Sure,
like in the opposite direction almost. There's also, this is another theory, something called, okay, I've heard two ways of saying it, ideomotor response or idiomotor response. It's a concept that physician William Benjamin Carpenter coined in 1852 after observing like different paranormal communicating methods that are based on small movements from other participants. So he was like, what's going on here? Basically, like a Ouija board or a table shaking during a seance, he claims that people are actually experiencing reflexes, small involuntary movements that I guess we all make from time to time.
Yeah.
People don't normally notice these small involuntary movements because they do happen on a regular basis, but we're not focusing on them. We have so many things happening around us that we wouldn't even realize it's happening.
Well, and then there's also the idea that your subconscious can have very micro influences on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is how, like you said, Ouija boards work.
Exactly. So there's a lot going on here. So if you have a group of people together and you ask them to simultaneously focus on an object and observe any movement, well, that would be the perfect time to notice. I think a lot of people already suspected that something like this was happening, like you said, so I'm not denying it. It's kind of nice to have a name to it. I never realized what it was technically called. But I also want to say, I love it when prestigious scientists take the time to debunk anything paranormal. Like, not because they're necessarily right or wrong or whatever, but I love the idea that they're reading their, like, I don't know, physics book, and they kind of look up and say, damn, why is that table moving during a seance?
I got to figure this out.
Now I can't focus on my equations. Like, I don't know. I just love that.
How am I supposed to have dinner when that table's been moving?
Come on.
Let's find out.
I don't know. It just, like, it makes me happy. So with all that said, no one can 100% know what's going on. Whether it was all a trick from a participant, some of the participants, or none of them, I don't know. Did they succeed in communicating with something? That's the issue. So today, there have been other groups who tried to replicate the experiment, the Philip experiment, to a T. So, like, kind of, except for that first 1 year situation, the other stuff.
Yeah, nobody got time for that.
No one has a year, y'all. But with a disappointing result, there was nothing. Like, there was no one was able to really replicate it. Nothing really occurred of note. And with time, a lot of this doubt started to accumulate, and over the years, the group's integrity has plummeted. So at the time, it was very interesting. People really believed something was going on.
Sure.
But as people can't, like, you know what I mean? The whole point of a scientific experiment or method, basically the methods, is that you can replicate them.
Yep. And if you can't replicate it, it was a failed experiment.
And you're like, well, what's going on here? So.
And that there, kids, is the most important part of actually scientific experiments. Because a lot of people say, look what I did, look what I proved. But if you cannot duplicate it, if you cannot replicate it, if you cannot make it happen again, then it was wrong.
In multiple ways, too.
Accurate. You didn't prove or disprove anything.
It's just, at some point, you can't. And they could not. Now, there is a movie loosely based on this experiment called The Quiet Ones. I think I've literally heard this.
I've heard of that name, too.
I've never saw it. And it's funny because when I looked it up, I'm like, I totally know this movie. I've just never seen it. It just slipped through. But it does have a 5.1 on IMDb out of 10. It's actually not that bad for a horror movie. I'm going to watch it anyway, so whatever. But yeah, that is the story of the Philip experiment.
Yeah, so I don't believe any of it. The only thing that gives me a little bit of second guessing is if they were contacting something else, but they went in knowing that this was fake, and I get it. What I'm really curious about is the guy and his wife who decided they wanted to do this experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious to see what their thoughts were on paranormal stuff in general. Did they believe in it? Did they think this was real? Did they not? What previous experience had they been previously exposed or experienced seances in a more traditional venue? Like, what was their purpose? Why did they want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think motive has a lot to do with understanding the experiment. I don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they didn't believe it, and they're just like, well, what if we're finding out something that people can do and people just think it's spirits and ghosts because that's what they're relating to in previous seances. We're trying to do something new. Or did they believe it? And they're like, but can we create something new? Like, I just wish I knew more about that.
I know. And it's kind of a frustrating too. I wish that this experiment would have taken place at the very least in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been a lot more accessible to get a recorder all the time to have filming almost the entire sessions, every session, every time. But there wasn't. It was not that possible. I think there was more audio, and I couldn't find a lot of it online anymore. It seems like it kind of, I don't even know how I found this. It just, like, popped out. I saw this, like, one link, or, like, somebody mentioned it during an article that I was reading on something else, and I was like, Philip, what are you talking about? And I was able to deep dive a little bit, but despite how much data they collected, it's just, it doesn't matter if you don't have other physical proof or replicate, like the replication situation.
Write down everything.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can write down everything. I can create a nice story for you right now, y'all, but it doesn't mean a whole lot to a lot of people these days, especially, I think.
Yeah.
So it doesn't pop up a lot for people. But sure. It is interesting. I mean, these people did do it. There is some. There was a news reporter who actually tried recording them. You know, it's worth a look.
I want to see them flip a table without using their hands.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, Philip.
All right, that was interesting. Yeah. I'm going to watch that video after this.
I hope you do, because I thought it was pretty cool. It is rough.
Yeah, that's fine.
1972 I'm down with rough
videos.
Yeah.
All right, well, that was a good story, and I think we should take a quick break, get a drink refreshment, and then come back, because I got a little story for you, too.
Ooh, okay. Okay, so we're back, and I have my other Jarritos little drink, so we're good.
Someone's getting drunk.
Ooh, 5%.
All right, my story today is actually a cryptid. And there is a chance that you have heard of it, Lily. In fact, there's a good chance that many of our listeners have heard of it. I hadn't, but that doesn't mean anything because I don't speak Spanish and I'm not special.
Aw.
But today, I'm going to talk about Coco, the Pixar film.
Oh, my.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I was like, I'm kidding about the Pixar connection. I am going to talk about El Coco, sometimes referred to as El Cuco. La Cuca, Cucuy.
I was going to say El Cucuy.
And even the Coco Man. I'm not even joking.
El Cucuy. That's my mom literally will tell me that to just not go somewhere.
Yep. So I've heard all, like, it's being used interchangeably. So you're going to hear me say El Coco or Cucuy. You're going to hear me say both of these throughout this because that's how a lot of people do it. So I want you all to think back to when you were children. Remember a moment when you were lying in bed at night, unable to go to sleep. Your whole house was quiet and dark, and you were the only one left awake. Your room was pitch black, except for a faint glow, perhaps from your alarm clock's bright red numbers, hard to see in the day, but like sinister spotlights in the night. Or perhaps you were a lucky child whose parents installed a nightlight in your room, its warm glow calming nearby, but increasingly unsettling the further away it gets as shadows grow longer as they lean away. Your eyes dart around the room, every nook and cranny of your room showing you its hidden second half, the half with secrets. Perhaps like me, your closet was propped open, unable to close because of the mountains of crap you stuffed in there instead of cleaning properly. Unilluminated. A perfect home for those things that go bump in the night. Then suddenly, you hear a noise. What could be making that noise? It's the middle of the night. Perhaps some object was just settling down. But why hadn't it settled down in the last however many weeks preceding this moment that caused you to panic? You suddenly become keenly aware of your extremities. Your brain takes an instant survey of all your limbs, ensuring they are all under the impenetrable shield that is your blanket. Hands, check. Left foot, check. Right foot, well, it's under the blanket, but dangerously close to the edge of the bed. Perhaps a weakness might be found in the blanket. You move your foot closer in. Check. Head, exposed. You raise the blanket to just above your nose. Now is the most dangerous choice. Do you hide your head and attempt to protect yourself, but risking being unaware of what the actions of whatever present evil is there is doing? Or do you keep your eyes exposed, allowing you to see any and all dangers? This is the choice you must make, and it could be your last. Were you a good kid, or were you a troublemaker? The difference could mean making it to the morning or feeling sharp teeth dig into your forehead as you become the latest meal of El Coco.
That was beautiful.
Originating in Spain and Portugal, particularly the region of Galicia, I've also heard Galicia and Galicia, El Coco can be equated to a version of the boogeyman that has since spread into most other Spanish and Portuguese-speaking cultures. Author David Bowles claims that many variants of the name evoke the feeling of, quote, stuttering sounds from the mouths of a very few fearful children who have seen it in the shadows and lived, for a time, to tell the tale, end quote. But from a practical standpoint, both its age and the number of name variants suggest that this cryptid has understandably become nuanced and widely varied depending on which region you are referring to. As El Cuco or La Cuca would indicate, some variants of the lore refer to it as a male monster, whereas others refer to it as a female monster. The name Coco means coconut, but also skull, and in some instances, head. It is believed that many use to interpret the three indentations or holes on a coconut shell as being similar to that of a skull.
Ooh, picture time.
I'm showing her a picture of a coconut just for visual flair, because it really does have, it does kind of look like a creepy skull.
It does. It kind of looks like a bowling ball, but yeah.
Famous Portuguese historian, it's in Portuguese, I'm going to ruin it. João de Barros postulated that the name coconut was actually derived from the pre-existing mythical creature El Coco, because the fruit skull shape reminded sailors of the monster, meaning that coconut might have gotten its name because of the monster. I don't know how true that is, but this was postulated hundreds of years ago by this historian. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's something that was suggested.
That would be pretty amazing if it did.
Yeah, I'm just reiterating stuff I read online. I don't know how true this is, but the legend of El Coco was often told by parents to their children in the form of lullabies or poems. It was used as a method of enforcing good behavior in children, just like the boogeyman. Mm-hmm. El Coco is personified either as a child eater or as a kidnapper, depending on which variant. El Coco is often described as looking like a shadow, always present, and always watching children. Some versions of the story claim El Coco watches from the rooftops at night. But only misbehaving children should worry, as El Coco has no interest in good children.
Well, that was not relayed to me.
Don't worry.
I would say, I was a pretty good kid, but my mom would only ever tell me if I was about to do something that was not cute. If I was going to be misbehaving.
And what would she say? How would she say it?
She'd be like, well, it depends. Like, he's going to get you, or like, don't go there.
El Cucuy is coming or something?
Yeah, he'll come, or the Cucuy's over there. Like, so don't go over there. You're like, okay.
So now you did hear this.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Was it outside? Was it in the house? Could it be both?
It was always outside.
So it was like, don't go there, don't leave, don't stray.
Right, or they'll catch you, which basically is not wrong because, you know.
Pedophiles.
Pedos, for one.
The ultimate Cucuy.
Yeah, you don't want to be in a sex trafficking ring. You're like, wow, yeah. The Cucuy is very organized. But yeah, basically that's what they were preventing is my assumption.
Yeah, so this was used on you.
All the time. Well, mostly when I was teeny tiny, and also like aunts and uncles, I'd be with my cousin, they'd be like, don't let the Cucuy get you, don't go over there. And you're like, okay.
All right, I think it's time we start introducing this to our nephew.
I think he already probably knows, but.
He's only like, what, 4? He turns 5 soon?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's time to start putting the fear into him.
I think you're like, you know, on your side, our nephew, he might want to know. I don't know.
It's hard to say definitively what El Coco is supposed to look like because different versions of the story have wildly different interpretations. All variants of the archetypal boogeyman tend to have this lack of concrete definitions, and it can be argued that this is one of the reasons that makes it such a widespread and enduring cryptid. What might be horrifying to one group might not be to another, so its specifics are ill-defined, and thus it can exist in both groups, be described differently, and be equally terrifying and have the same purpose. One of the more consistent factors is that El Coco is apparently a horrible sight to behold. Unsettling, upsetting, or downright terrifying. Cucuy has grown to encompass various other versions of the boogeyman in its cultures into their own lore. They are all Cucuy, all the same, yet all different. In Portugal, El Coco is often described as looking like an old man who carries a large sack to stuff children into and take them away.
Ah, like Krampus.
Yeah, these European variants often personify El Coco as a kidnapper that takes children away, not necessarily someone who is killing or eating them. Mm-hmm. Maybe to do it later, but at the moment they're being taken away, not being eaten on the spot. These variations tend to have more human-like forms to them. Yet in some Latin American areas, Cucuy is often described as looking like a bird, such as an owl that watches from the rooftops. Mm-hmm. Some versions of the story also interpret it as the same thing as Bicho Papau, another boogeyman variant which can allegedly change its shape and morph into any child's greatest fear.
Ah, that would be the worst one.
The worst one, right? Sometimes it can be hard to differentiate with other versions of the boogeyman and can be described as a hairy creature that hides under beds or in closets. A version from Venezuela known as El Silbon.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that one.
About someone who murdered his parents and carries his father's bones on his back. At night, if you hear a rattling sound of bones, you should be wary because it means he's now by. Yeah,
he whistles in the trees, I think.
Yeah. Another related variant from Brazil is an anthropomorphic female alligator known as Cuca. She is unattractive and has dirty hair and carries a sack on her back as well. The sack seems to be in line with other versions of the story. However, in this iteration, she even goes after good children. And the assumption is the sack, once again.
Fucking rude.
One interesting pattern about Kukui's visual representation has to do with the environment in which each culture resides. In tropical and wetter environments, El Coco or Kukui tends to have more reptilian traits. Mm. And in more wooded or drier climates, El Coco tends to be personified as a hairy creature.
Oh, nice. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I love it. Because I'm like, totally here, it'd be hairy.
Exactly.
But like, I could imagine if you're in like Brazil, it's like, no, it's an alligator because that's here.
Yeah, it's like we see lizards all day long. So, yeah. Well, I guess maybe in Miami too. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Florida is like, yeah, we have alligators. You really gotta up the game if it's going to be scary.
Gotta know the things that kids are already scared to be like, yeah, it's like that, but worse.
Right.
The oldest known rhyme of El Coco is from the 17th century and is the, I'm going to have Lily say it in Spanish because.
Where is it?
Oh, it's right there. So she's going to say it because I can't do Spanish very well. So she's going to say the Spanish verses.
So I'm going to guess where the accent's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so it's Auto de los Desposorios de la Virgen by Juan Cajés, or is it Caxés?
I don't know.
Okay, well, there you go. Duérmete, niño, duérmete ya, que viene el coco y te comerá. Sleep, child. Oh, wait, you can read that part. Okay.
Which translates roughly to sleep, child, sleep or else, coco will come and eat you. And apparently this is, like in a lot of areas, this is a common thing for people to say to their kids when they're going to bed.
It's yeah.
Like, go to bed so you don't get eaten by the monster.
Yep.
When reading about...
That's actually, I'm starting to literally... Things are coming back into my head.
You're getting some memories?
Yeah, what the hell, man?
Tell me.
So my mom would always be like, go to bed, or you know what I mean? Or like, you don't want to be awake when there could be like bad people are awake this time or something. I don't know. Like weird things are coming back to me right now. So I'm wondering if she was actually talking about.
Yeah, there's that famous saying about like at night is when only bad people are out about at night.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to be up at those times.
I'm like, thanks, mom. What are we, German? Like we have like. Also horrible, like, mm-hmm. nighttime. It was like, what happened to the classics, man? Like, tell me about a princess in the castle. Not that there's something that's going to grab you in the middle of the night if you're not asleep.
Sounds a little bit like child abuse.
It's a little aggressive.
When reading about El Coco, I ran into stories about some variants of the story that I wasn't sure how related they were. They might be independent or marginally related. They include the Santa Coca, a female dragon seen during the Corpus Christi celebrations, and during the celebration, a manifestation of the female dragon, which as far as I can tell was like several people in a giant dragon costume, would fight against a guy on a horse who was supposed to be Saint George. And in this like performance, if the dragon won, it meant that they were going to have bad crops that year. And the weird thing is apparently the crowd always cheers on the dragon, which doesn't make sense, but I think it's just people like the dragon.
Wait a minute. Well, it's kind of like Groundhog's Day, or like it's just
you know, but we don't want more winter.
No, I know, but everyone cheers when he comes out.
That's true. That's
and you're like, point. What the hell?
Yeah,
isn't that
might
bad?
Because people just like seeing the dragon, I guess.
Right.
Which I think brings about the most difficult part of describing El Coco and all its variants. There are just so many, and someone could write entire books about people's interpretations and different stories. But the most distilled, simplified form of this is quite simply a monster that punishes children who misbehave. And whichever version you grew up with is unquestionably going to be the scariest one you know. Mm. I'm sure anyone listening to this who had their own version, it's different than what I was describing, but they're like, no, that's not right. But I'm like, yeah, you probably heard one, and that's it to you. Right. I never heard of any of these. I mean, I heard of the boogeyman, I guess, but like... It seems like this is similar. Very well known. And according to my research, in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado is when he's known as the Coco Man.
Oh, like, really?
The Coco so Man's Coco coming Man? To get you.
I don't think I need to talk to some of my New Mexican friends and see what's
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I want to ask more people if they know this.
Yeah.
So in the media, there are several things. The famous epic novel Don Quixote. There is the line, Fue el espantajo y el coco, which translates to he was the scarecrow and the coco of the world. Mm. And Goya, the famous painter Goya,
yes.
created a work called
I can see
Que that. Viene el Coco.
Yeah.
Depicting the monster wearing a cloak coming after children. It's actually a really terrifying picture because the
it's
kids are scared.
It's actually horrible, but also the mom's there, so it's almost like
even the mom's scared
she
this
couldn't
time.
Protect you, which is very Goya.
It's like, yeah, it's like your kids suck. You're going to watch them get eaten now.
Yeah.
El Cucuy has appeared as monsters and villains in shows such as Grimm and The Wizards of Waverly Place. Yeah, right? And in 2018, a film called Kukui, the Boogeyman was released. It has a slightly less exciting IMDb rating than the one that you told me about.
At only
4.6. And it only seems to be available to stream on the Sci-Fi Channel website, so that gives me even less hope for it.
It gives me a lot of hope, actually.
But, you know, we'll see what happens there.
We'll see.
Now, there's one final thing I want to mention about El Coco and, by extension, the Boogeyman in general. I don't know a single person that hasn't heard of this creature in some form or another. Independent of what specific name you give it, it just doesn't matter. It seems to be something that cultures acknowledge and have for centuries, if not millennia. And with that in mind, it means that there's also something that parents actively acknowledge. Sure, when we were children and scared of the dark, most, or at least I hope most of us, were calmed down by our parents. They reassured us of our safety and swore to us that monsters don't exist. It was all in our mind. Yet, I will also go out on a limb and say that most of you, and as we've discovered Lily here, have also been told at some point by your parents to behave, or have been told that there was something that you either must do or must not do. And if we failed that, if we misbehaved, the boogeyman will get us. This contradictory approach would suggest that when they said monsters don't exist, they were lying. By our parents' own admission, monsters were real, or at the very least, El Coco, a.k.a. the boogeyman, was the exception when it comes to the non-existence of monsters. So was it just an evil way to keep us kids behaved, or were our parents right, and El Coco is waiting?
Oh, he there. He's there.
So that is El Coco, a small variant of the boogeyman that I read about and I got excited.
I love it. I really do like hearing about it because I knew it was definitely within the Mexican culture for sure. I've heard of it, people talking about it here in New Mexico too. I don't know if I've ever heard them say Coco. I always hear people say Cucuy.
Mm-hmm. I never heard of any of them, so.
Sure.
I was going with Coco because it's easier for me to pronounce than Cucuy.
For sure. I can see that. But I love this story. I didn't realize how much how it transcended into so many different cultures.
All over Portugal and Spain, which those cultures are often related, the similarities in the language and their proximity in Europe and how they kind of both spread about into like Latin America and whatnot, they're always going to be kind of linked in some way.
And there's yeah.
And this is just one of the many ways that they get linked as this kind of became their version of the boogeyman.
But hearing their names and what they would look like, that's cool too. Because I think if I'm trying to really think about what it was that I was envisioning, I'm guessing it was more of a shadowy, overlooming, use your imagination, kid, kind of situation. Because my mom never described it to me. She was never like, and with its long fangs, it'll grab you. Like, nothing that specific. But he would just tell me, like, oh, there's something out there.
And it's going to get you.
Did
you think it was going to eat you or take you?
Oh, take me.
Take you. So you weren't being told you were going to have teeth driven into your flesh. It was like, you're going to be taken away.
My mom always said, and we'll never see you again. And I was like, no. And that's horrifying when you're a kid.
Yeah. And I think that also makes it more in line with reality of kidnappers and stuff. Because, you know, people aren't trying to eat you in general. That's rare.
No, it's very rare.
But kidnappers are disturbingly not rare. So.
Exactly. Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's my story.
I love it.
Before we go, I want to talk real quick, super quick. I want to talk about a movie. Last week, Lily and I went to see The First Omen in theaters. Ooh. And it is a prequel to the 1976 original film that starred Gregory Peck and was directed by Richard Donner. Lily and I are huge fans of the original. It's a great example of an older horror film that still holds up by today's standards. And because of its quality, it ended up spawning a whole series of sequels, and most of them are not very good. So Lily and I were very cautious when it came to seeing this latest one. We were really worried about it being another Exorcist Believer. Ugh.
Oh, God. Woof. That was woof. That's all.
That movie sucked. But anyway, now, since this movie is still in theaters and it just came out, we're not doing a review. We're not doing spoilers or anything. But we did want to take a moment to tell you guys this movie was great.
Watch it.
And you guys should go see it. Now, do you need to see it in theaters? Not necessarily. Like, it's not like Dune or these huge blockbuster movies where it's like, oh my god, you have to see it in the big theater. But I will say it is a very beautifully shot film, and it is so rare to see a good horror film in theaters that isn't a slasher these days, because they just aren't that many that make it to theaters. Sure. So it's kind of a good experience. I really enjoyed seeing it in theaters, so I'm just recommending everyone out there, if you like horror films, and if you like smart, intelligent...
Or at least well-made, you know, they know what to do with their budget.
Yeah, this isn't like a... This isn't cash, a jump scare...
Cash grab? Is that
yeah, this isn't a cash grabby, okay. jump scare, cheap gimmick movie. This is a... I would say this feels like a very mature horror film.
Like, whoever made this movie, who wrote it and directed it, they loved it too.
Yeah. So, if you like good horror films, this is a movie to see. See it in theaters or wait till it comes out, but you absolutely should see it. Mm. It's really good. I just wanted to say that real quick. So, no spoilers, no review. We're not going to tell you about the plot or anything like that. Maybe on a later episode, maybe we'll talk about it around Halloween or something, but we don't want you guys to have anything to keep you from seeing it. It's good. I liked it. And I think that brings our episode to a close.
Yeah, I think so. This is the end. If this is your first episode with us, welcome, and I hope you had as much fun as we did. If it isn't your first episode, thanks for not abandoning us. Remember, you can always email us at hotwpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our various social media platforms with story suggestions or with your own spooky experience for the next listener's episode.
And if you have your own kukui story about what your parents told you or what you've seen, please send it to us. Not only could we include it on User Listener, or we might just read it on the show, or you know what? Maybe we'll just read it because we want to see it. So you just let us know.
We just want to know.
Yeah, I want to hear that.
I think that's a really good idea. I love that. Lastly, as we always say, if you find yourself having a work week hangover or a I want to go see the new Omen movie and needed a little liquid courage kind of hangover, well, don't worry, because the best cure for a hangover
is fear.
Bye.